Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound. It's John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Scratchy, but feeling good on this Christmas Eve morning. Thanks for tuning in to the award-winning For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, since we passed the five-year mark of the tragedy at Sandy Hook Elementary School, we're going to check back in with Dr. Jeremy Richmond, who lost his daughter Aviel on that fateful day. We're going to learn how the Aviel Foundation, which was started to memorialize this young life lost, is funding research programs looking at brain health and is supporting new programs in 2018 to help loved ones better understand and support young people who may be negatively affected by trauma and other factors. Then we're going to spend a few minutes catching up with the Connecticut Council on Environmental Quality, which just released an interim report focused on the challenges the state is facing regarding the control of dangerous pesticides. And we'll close with an encore presentation of a segment we taped earlier this year with the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, talking about the state's energy strategy. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Voquette, right after this reminder. The Midwestern Connecticut Council of Alcoholism, MCCA, is helping family members understand how critical it is to take care of themselves and let go of feelings of shame and guilt associated with a loved one's addiction with a program called How to Cope. Through the process of understanding the disease of addiction and constructing a personal plan of action, participants begin to restore balance to their lives. The next session of How to Cope starts on January 11th at MCCA's office in Danbury, and each session runs for 7 weeks and meets Thursday evenings for 2 hours. The groups are small and confidential, and if you'd like more information, you can go to mccaonline.com.
Well, we're very pleased to be invited back to talk with Dr. Jeremy Richmond. He, along with his wife, Jennifer Hensel, formed the Aviel Foundation. They're passionate about preventing violence and building compassion through brain research, community engagement, and education. The Aviel Foundation is a 501c3 nonprofit that was established in honor of six-year-old Aviel Rose Richmond, who was murdered on December 14, 2012, at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown. Jeremy's been a guest on our program several times before as some of the really exciting developments have started to take hold that he and Jennifer and his team have been supporting going back now almost 5 years. I'm also pleased to be joined by a couple of folks who I've known for a long time. Susie DeYoung is here, as well as Nick Hoffman. They're on the team with the Aviel Foundation. So, Jeremy, essentially just remind folks about the kind of the two-sided desire and energy that's going behind the work that you're doing here.
Yeah, our mission really quickly after the 2012 murders became playing to our strengths as scientists. One, we wanted to address the scientific side of why do people act violently and aggressively? What are the risk factors in the environment that lead to aggression and violence? What are the protective factors that lead away from that? And what can we understand by studying the brain to illustrate why those risk factors have the role that they do in leading to a change in behaviors? So that's the one side of the mission, the research side, and we can talk about that. But we also recognize that science in a vacuum has little to no value unless you can give it to the everyday person in a way that makes clear sense, that's digestible, approachable, something that they can take home. And in times of personal crisis, they can reach into a toolbox and find something of value. So the second half of our mission is community engagement and education so that we can really build bridges between the science and the behaviors and give it to the everyday citizen.
The horrific situation that inspired this whole thing is known around the world. As you travel around the country and around the world, however, and you're engaging other peers, other scientists, I'm interested in hearing about the reaction. Are you getting feedback like this is finally something whose time has come?
It's actually remarkable. I mean, essentially, there's three reactions that we get when we talk about it. The first is when we talk about the tragedy, the same reaction that we had, everybody has, is this: why do these things happen? Why do these sensationalized acts happen? You know, you have South Carolina, and you have Orlando, and you have, I mean, we could, unfortunately, Las Vegas, we could go on and on. And that really overshadows the fact that these tragedies happen on our street corners and in our houses on a daily basis. And everybody wants to know why. And that's the expertise of scientists. That's what we do for a living. The second reaction is exactly what you were just alluding to, is why haven't we done this? This is a huge unmet need. And this is the reaction from psychiatrists, neurologists, neuroscientists, philosophers, law enforcement, teachers, parents. We don't do this. We don't know this. We haven't been looking under this lamppost, turning these rocks over. And the fact is, no, which is in some degrees frustrating, really. But in others, it really it helps to motivate us, because we recognize that there's a lot of value in turning these rocks over. And the third reaction is completely unrelated, but that's the sentiment. I can't imagine what you're going through. I can't imagine what it'd be like to lose my child that way. And while we appreciate the sentiment, the irony is that what they're doing, just starting to do when they express that, is to imagine and to close their eyes for a second and introspect and think about what that would be like, walk around in our shoes. And we not only think it's important to express that empathy, that compassion, but that it's a responsibility to do so. It's not until you let something touch you personally, it's not until you walk around in somebody else's shoes that you're motivated to take action, to do something about it. So I love there's a quote by a rabbi, A.J. Heschel. He said, "Few are guilty, but all are responsible." And we feel that everybody is responsible for taking care of their own health, the health of their loved ones, the communities that we live in. And so we all are obligated to imagine, to think outside of our comfort zone. And on the brighter side of that imagination tunnel, it's the imagination that sets us free to make the world a beautiful place and make it better tomorrow than it is today.
And that is the hopeful result and actual, I guess, the beginnings of proven outcomes from research studies that are being funded through the organization, the Avielle Foundation. And folks, if you're just joining us, we're with Dr. Jeremy Richman, Susie DeYoung, and Nick Hoffman here at the headquarters of the Avielle Foundation. Avielle, A-V-I-E-L-L-E, foundation.org is their website if you'd like to really dig deep and find out more about what we're talking about in this short interview, or if you'd like to support them or maybe come out and be part of something that they're doing. So, Jeremy, let's talk about the research and how it's already getting some traction.
Well, yeah, we're 5 years in now as we approach the 5 year anniversary of the 1214 tragedy, and we're really committed and we're very excited and proud of the successes and the progress that we've made, entirely built on the grassroots support that we've had from around the world. Specifically, in the research arena, we put out a call for applications to look into the public health or neuroscience basis of violence or compassion. And we had a number of really outstanding applications, but it was a lot of responsibility to identify sort of the most likely winning horses, so to speak. And we not only feel entirely charged and excited about the people that we did fund, but it really surpassed our expectations. At the University of Northern Colorado, two researchers studied in a public health sense the long-term life consequences of childhood abuse, neglect, and misbehavior. in their adulthood. Mm. And their findings were really outstanding. They found all kinds of long-term consequences. And they're studying college students who, despite the odds of having experienced a lot of trauma and adversity in their childhood, still made it into college, which is statistically lower than for everybody else. Mm. But they're not free and clear. It turns out that they have a lot of difficulties in school. And some of them are really subtle and very tragic. One example is a lot of these kids, as they grow into adults, they perceive other people's body language, facial gestures, and even what they're saying incorrectly. And not only incorrectly, but oftentimes in a hostile fashion when it wasn't intended that way. And that can have all kinds of consequences in your daily life. These findings were so profound and so well studied that it merited publication in one of our top tier peer reviewed scientific journals. The next lab is the University of Michigan. We funded another duo team there, and this is our neuroscience grant award. And these individuals were looking to find funding for a pilot study, a study that would support further funding and further research because they weren't able to get funding in the past. And what they had proposed to do was look at what they call discordant twins. So what they look at are identical twins that are raised in the same household, but that have different behavioral traits, where one of the twins has aggressive, antisocial, violent disorder, and the other does not. The evil twin, right. And what we're finding from their results, this pilot study, is fascinating that here you have a very controlled environment. They're genetically identical, and their environment is very similar. So differences in the behaviors can be attributed to differences in chemistry, brain structure, and brain activity. And they found a number of phenomenally distinct differences between the twins. Mm-hmm. This was so profoundly important data that not only did it result in publications, but it resulted in the big funding so the pilot study was such a success that now they have two large NIH grants and a training grant that total over $7.5 million. Yep. So the return on investment is manyfold. And that speaks to the unmet need that we were talking about earlier. And the third grant was given to this was our Luminary Award. This was given to somebody that didn't apply for it, but that we think is just doing such out of the box research to understand the nature of violence and compassion, that we awarded Terry Moffitt at Duke University the Luminary Award. She's a real pioneer when it comes to building bridges between genetics, neuroscience, and the behavioral psychology and social sciences that we see the behaviors in. And their data looked at the socioeconomic burden, the most costly economic burdens that different communities face. Crime, prescription drug use, hospitalized nights spent in a hospital, morbidity, so how often you see a doctor, prescription drug filling. Notably, also obesity, cigarettes smoked, and fatherless hours. So being reared by a single parent. These are very expensive costs to an environment. And what they found through what's called a longitudinal study, a study that takes place from birth to now. This study started in 1972, so a lot of these individuals have grown up in the study. Yeah. So they have a lot of data that they can look back on and find correlations. And what they found was that 80% of this burden, economic burden, across the board can be attributed to a very small 20% of the population. That finding in and of itself matches what has been historically called in the economic arena the Pareto principle. That it was fascinating by itself, but they went a step further and they found that not only was this a discrete population, but they could identify who these people were going to be as early as the age of 3 with a brain health exam. And so and with incredible accuracy, 85 to 92% accuracy. So what that means is that now we need to fund studies that explore what interventions are effective to derail that trajectory. Mm-hmm. How do we make them productive, healthy, happy members of society that are actually productive instead of costly? Mm-hmm. This was such an important finding that it merited publication in the scientific arena's top tier peer reviewed journal, one of the Nature journals. And so we're really happy about that. And then finally, in the research arena, we've been proud to support a number of intern and research fellows, young, motivated college and high school students. Mm-hmm. And we've helped to support them many ways with just direct training, education, but also opportunity. We've given them opportunities to study and work in some of the world's best neuroscience labs. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to incentivize them to move into this brain health space so that they can lead the charge and make these discoveries that need to fill in these gaps, these unmet needs that need to be filled in. And they're having some incredible success. I mean, can you imagine a high school student getting published before they're even in college in, again, top-tier publications? And we have that now that we can kind of brag about.
As a result of them being placed in the team through the Aviel Foundation's work.
Exactly. So
I think it's important to know, too, that all of this is possible because donors got behind the mission and the vision of the mission. And we're literally taking the $5, $25, $30 donation and turning it into societal changing science. Mm-hmm. And we mentioned we have, you know, multiple applications. I think we're probably sitting on a dozen, 15. The Science Advisory Board will decide on in January.
For the next round,
yep. And we would love to have the financial wherewithal to fund multiple studies. It's we're not necessarily picking a winner. We're picking the one that we feel is the most viable. But, you know, of those dozen, 15, probably, 90% of them could really change the way we understand behavior in the brain. And it's ultimately because of, the compassion and the desire for change from the donors who click the donate now button or send in a check. And it's really, this is how change happens in society, is when people band together and say, enough's enough. We've got to figure this out and kind of fly in the face of the structures that are inhibiting this science from happening.
Yeah. Well, enough can't be said about the proven track record of the investments that the Aviel Foundation has made in an incredibly short time. We heard about a study that's been in mulling since 1972, and here, as a result of an important piece of underwriting, they've kind of turned a chapter into some outcomes that can inspire a greater confidence in bankability factor. I mean, it is really all about the money.
Absolutely. I mean, that's what allows us to provoke the change, and not, we're not chasing money for the sake of greed. We're chasing money for the sake of, making our society less violent and more compassionate.
Yeah.
And we just look at the trajectory of the foundation, and we're approaching a year financially that's going to match our initial year. So, a lot of those donors who initially engaged because their hearts were broken and still are, now see what the foundation's doing, and we're fulfilling the mission that Jeremy and Jen had days after to create that protective founder factor around themselves. How do we do anything that makes any sense, now that we lost Aviel? Right. And the people who fueled that early on are now seeing the outcomes of that mission. And, we're just chasing, more outcomes to provoke this. So the young interns are going to be the next generation neuroscientists who, are able to really identify where violence happens and how it happens in the brain, how we can prevent it. But then, you know, the other side of the coin, the compassion side is just as important. You know, how do we get this in schools and get it to communities at large where we're really nurturing and celebrating compassion and not viewing it as vulnerability or weakness?
Yeah, a really important part of, I think, what drives people to make that $5, that $20, that $100 donation to the Aviel Foundation through avielfoundation.org is knowing that there's proof there, but also because they're getting something back. And that's what brings us to Susie DeYoung, who's going to talk about a really exciting new project series that is being launched in 2018 that virtually anyone within the sound of our voice can attend or take advantage of. Almost all, if not all, are open to the public. It's called the Brainstorm Experience. Susie, tell us a little bit about what's in store. There's one coming up rather quickly in early January.
Yes, there is. January 4th is the kickoff Brainstorm Experience. Just a little background, you know, you just heard about the research end of things. Well, Brainstorm is taking that and applying it on a local community level. Mm-hmm. So how do you take that and apply it to the average person, the average community as a whole to foster brain health here locally? And that's what Brainstorm is. Mm-hmm. So it is a year-long series that will bring the community together for a series of talks and experiences that serve to educate, inspire, provoke the imagination. To me, one of the most important and wonderful things our brain is capable of is the ability to ask questions, is curiosity. Mm. And that's what we want to inspire, is not just conversation, but curiosity, looking at things from a different perspective. Mm. So brain health champions, as we call them, as all the people who are coming in for our series are people who can inspire that conversation, can take brain health / mental health, which to some people is, you know, a taboo subject, and bring it into the conversation that we can talk about comfortably. So yes, January 4th kicks off with Steve Gross, who is with the Life is Good Playmaker Foundation. He is the chief playmaker for the Life is Good Kids Foundation. Mm-hmm. Forgive me. Steve basically goes into community situations that have suffered traumas, be it from natural disasters or from violence, and works with largely the youth population there to help them recover through the power of optimism and play. He is our first speaker, and he is followed by a series of other speakers. February, we have Kevin Hines, who is a survivor of an attempted suicide. Kevin jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge and survived. He's the only survivor who has gone on to use this opportunity to help other people. Mm-hmm. And he is an incredible speaker. In April, we have Dan Harris, who people may know from ABC News Nightline. He is a host of Good Morning America, of Nightline. He was the last person to get involved in brain health. He really, you know, was not one to embrace any of that, but he did suffer PTSD from being a war correspondent, as well as he had a drug problem for many years. And it wasn't until he was assigned the religious beat that he started learning a little bit more about mindfulness and meditation, and has since embraced it, but in a way that the person who may not necessarily embrace that can hear and understand. And he's very funny, and he's learned a lot from his experience. So he's coming in April. In May, we have Rosalind Wiseman, an author, who she wrote the book Queen Bees and Wannabes, which was the basis for the movie Mean Girls, has since written a number of other books, basically helping parents better connect with their kids. She'll be talking about why it's so difficult for kids to tell their parents when something is wrong. Mm-hmm. And that talk will be great for older children and teenagers and young adults to attend as well. Jane Pauley, people may remember from the Today Show, now a CBS morning news correspondent. Mm-hmm. Jane Pauley has spoken more in recent years about her bipolar, living with bipolar. She'll be talking about that. And in August, we have Dr. Bessel van der Kolk, who wrote a best-selling book called The Body Keeps the Score. He is all about trauma, and he is one of the better-known speakers, authors, when it comes to understanding the effects that trauma have, not just on our psychology, but on our bodies, particularly our bodies. He will be here as part of This will be the sixth annual Newtown Yoga Fest, which is also coming under the Brainstorm umbrella now. Dr. Vander Kolk is very vocal about his feelings of yoga ties into trauma, how yoga ties into trauma recovery. So all these people, you know, clearly have something in common in that they foster conversation about brain health.
The Aviel Foundation has also underwritten some mental health first aid training.
Yes, it has. In fact, this is the Brainstorm experience I just described to you. And why we call it the experience is because we don't want to just bring in speakers. We want to have people engage in this experience. So it's not just listening to a lecture. It's actually things people can become involved in. But under the umbrella of Brainstorm is also brain health first aid training, which the Aviel Foundation has run a series for community members. All Newtown teachers have been trained through the foundation. Also under Brainstorm is an after-school program at Reed that will be starting up again in January.
At the Reed Intermediate School in Newtown. That's great. Thank you, Susie DeYoung, and we heard also from Nick Hoffman, both on the team here at Aviel Foundation, for the last minute or so that we have. We'll go back to one of the organization's co-founders, Dr. Jeremy Richman, who's invited us in to chat with him here just a couple of days before another 12-14, the fifth 12-14. So, Jeremy, tell folks how they can learn more, get in touch.
Well, they can go to – certainly they can you reach out to us on our social media portals. So we have Aviel Foundation on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter at Avi, A-V-I-E Foundation, and also on Instagram and LinkedIn. But probably the best place to do so, to find out about us, would be to go to our website at avielefoundation.org. And dig in and learn about it. There's a lot of good resources, a lot of educational materials about brains, about brain health, about protective and risk factors. And most importantly, that's where you can donate.
Avielfoundation.org. As you're hearing just from the folks we talked to this morning, the Aviel Foundation is passionate about preventing violence and building compassion through brain research, community engagement, and education. Once again, A-V-I-E-L-L-E, foundation.org. Jeremy, thank you for having us. Best to Jennifer and Owen and Imogen, and always think about Aviel. Thank you so much.
I really appreciate the opportunity. Thanks, John.
Well, we do enjoy bringing back our good friends on the program at holiday time, and one of them is Carl Wagoner. He is on our program a couple of times a year representing the Council on Environmental Quality here in Connecticut. Carl is the executive director of that agency, and the Council on Environmental Quality, normally we have Carl on for extended segments because we're looking at big reports that have a lot of working parts. But his agency, beginning a week or two ago, has started issuing segments that are hyper-focused on particular issues of concern to the council. And the first one came out about a week or two ahead of our broadcast here, and it is focusing on pesticides. So we're going to take this segment of about 10 or 11 minutes just to kind of key folks in on some things they need to be thinking about going into the new year, maybe talking to their local or government officials, their state officials, their school districts, things like that. Carl, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us here on this kind of pre-holiday weekend.
Sure. It's always a pleasure, John.
So let's get right into the meat of this report, because I have been seeing a lot of attention about it in the media. Tell us a little bit about just the backstory on the lead up to the release of this pesticides focus.
Sure. It's no secret that the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, or DEEP as it's called, it has lost a lot of staff positions over the years, to the point where some enforcement is not getting done anymore. We're going to look at several programs, but we began by investigating the pesticides program at DEEP because the numbers there have declined more precipitously probably than in any other program. I mean, it's the number of inspections that are done and the number of violations that are fined and detected have plummeted over the years, to the point where if you, John, were to go out this afternoon and do something illegal with pesticides, it's highly unlikely that you would be detected. And even if you were, you probably would pay no penalty.
Right, right. You kind of liken it to, being out on the highway and you know, people speeding or not, speeding, whether they know troopers are around or not. And in fact, these enforcement officers apparently do as good a job as they can with the resources they have. But the, across the state of Connecticut, a half a dozen or so enforcement officers can't be where every misuser of pesticides is.
Yes, right. Even when there were twice as many inspectors, there was no chance that all of the violations were going to be detected. But if enough were, and enough people paid some consequences, word would get around. And, again, the analogy you used to the troopers. If you know there are no troopers on the highway, you know that some people are going to be violating the law, speeding. Mm-hmm. Not everybody, obviously, but there are people who only obey the law because they fear getting caught.
Right, and the ones that do the most damage are the ones who are most flagrant, and that does overlap to the illegal disposition or disposal or dumping of pesticides or the illegal use of them.
Right. Yeah, there are all sorts of different violations. I mean, companies apply pesticides that they're not supposed to be using. They don't have the right licensing and certification. There are rules regarding what pesticides can be sold in stores and how they can be stored and so forth. And DEEP does inspect stores and writes some of them up for improper handling of the merchandise. But it's way, way down. But it's as you suggest, it's the application of the pesticides, it's the certification and training of the people applying pesticides, it's the sale and storage, it's across the board.
Yeah, does the Enforcement Division, to the best of your knowledge, really have to depend gets the greatest success or closure of investigations when they do get tips from people about the suspected misuse?
Yes, I think that's correct. They do conduct unannounced inspections of stores and companies that whose business it is to apply pesticides, but they definitely respond to tips or complaints, whatever you want to call them. And your listeners should definitely call DEEP. I don't want to discourage people from calling DEEP, because if they spy something that looks wrong, regarding pesticides, or there's somebody spraying in their neighborhood and the spray is drifting across boundaries and it's ending up in their yard and they can smell it, oh yeah, they should definitely call DEEP, and DEEP will inspect it. And that's how a lot of the violations are found.
Yeah, very good. Folks, we're on the line with Carl Wagner. He's Executive Director of the Council on Environmental Quality. They submit the annual report on the status of Connecticut's environment to the governor pursuant to state statutes, and they publish special reports and make recommendations for legislation to correct environmental problems. Their newest focus is on pesticides, and there are a few recommended actions. We're going to come back with Carl and review those so you can hear them too right after a quick break. Carl, stick with us, folks. We'll be back in just a moment. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to this Christmas Eve edition of the award-winning For the People right after this news. Hey, if you're getting coats, hats, gloves, or other warm pieces of outerwear this holiday, think of Acts for Ministry, a non-denominational, non-profit, charitable organization serving the greater Waterbury area. They're seeking donations of winter coats and accessories for children and and adults during their annual Share the Warmth Drive through December 31st. They'll take blankets, new thermals, socks, scarves, gloves, all those kinds of things for adults and children. And you can drop them off at the Acts 4 Ministry offices on Thomaston Avenue in Waterbury, Mondays through Fridays from 9 to 3, or in the 24/7 white drop box outside the building at 1713 Thomaston Avenue. Learn more about this and the other agency efforts by going to acts4.org. That's A-C-T-S, the number 4.org. All right, we're back with Carl Wagner from the Council on Environmental Quality. Normally, we have him on for an extended period of time because we're talking about huge aspects of his agency's reporting that has multiple points. Now, the council is kind of taking things in different bites, and their first and most recent report in these segmented styles is on pesticides. We heard before the break about what the issue is, but the good news is that the report is making a number of recommendations that if any or all of them are followed, it's going to make a huge difference in the amount of potential exposure that folks who aren't intended to be exposed to pesticides will suffer. Carl, let's talk a little bit about these recommended actions.
Certainly, you know, and by way of background, you know, it's hard to find any environmental program that doesn't need more resources, more staff. But we try to stay away from just saying, well, deep, you know, appropriate more money to deep so they can hire more staff. But with regard to pesticides, the basis of enforcement is inspections. I mean, some programs like water and air, you have more modern monitoring equipment, when it's the data comes in electronically. With pesticides, you have to do inspections, and it needs more staff. But here's a real oddity. The pesticides program of DEEP already collects a lot of money because the manufacturers of the pesticides pay fees, the companies that are licensed pay fees, the stores that sell the restricted-use pesticides pay fees. And that money that comes in is more than DEEP needs to manage the pesticides program. But the money isn't kept by DEEP. It just goes into the state's general fund. So we are recommending that the money that is collected by the pesticides program of DEEP be used by DEEP to adequately enforce the laws. Because right now, only a little bit of that money gets back to DEEP for staffing, and the rest just, you know, goes into the state general fund, and it's an irony. I mean, to have a program generating all that revenue and not having anybody there hardly.
Right. You're also suggesting going paperless and taking on electronic reporting of sales and use data as another key item, as well as the restoration of monitoring of pesticide levels in Connecticut's environment. But I also like the last couple, including closing loopholes, which includes the one that allows a person to buy restricted-use pesticides from the Internet. Sort of sounds like an issue they're having with firearms.
Yeah, and some other products, too. But yes, I mean, for certain pesticides, the really dangerous ones, some of which are pretty common, you have to be certified in the state. It means you have to demonstrate your knowledge of how to use these things. You have to get a certification from the state before you can go to a special store and buy these products. But you or I can actually buy these over the Internet, which kind of puts, you know, doesn't it kind of defeats the purpose of the law. In fact, we tried it, and don't worry, we're not going to jail. We canceled the order before it was delivered. But, you know, we tested this system, and we were able to order this stuff.
Yeah, and I think probably the one that's closest to my heart and probably crosses over to a lot of other agencies is, you know, they say, you know, give a person a fish and they'll eat a meal, teach a person to fish and they'll eat forever. This idea of promoting sound techniques to control pests with fewer pesticides. It sounds so simple, and yet, it takes a report like this and all the resources and output of the Council on Environmental Quality to assert it. I'm hoping legislators take up that as a serious initiative in 2018. In the last 30 seconds or so that we have with you, Carl, anything else that you'd like to say about the report or let people know where they can go to read it?
Yes, it's easily found on our website, which is ct.gov/CEQ. Right there on the homepage, there's a link to the report. And, yeah, if people find it interesting, contact us at any time. Our email and phone number is there, and people can talk to their legislators about it, too, if they're so inclined.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Carl. Happy holidays, and great to have you again, folks. If you'd like to learn more, as you heard from Carl, ct.gov/CEQ for this and all of their past reporting and anything that's going to be coming up in the future, which we'll be talking about with Carl here on the program. In the meantime, Carl, thank you once again and all the work that you and your agency do to help folks here protect themselves in Connecticut from environmental dangers. And we'll talk to you again in 2018. Well, we often check in with our friends at the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, DEEP, for a range of subjects. I continue to be shocked and amazed at how many different ways Connecticut DEEP gets involved in our communities and in our lives, everything from the air we breathe to the water we drink and to the energy we consume. And you may not have heard, but Connecticut's Department of Energy and Environmental Protection just released a draft of an updated energy strategy for Connecticut, which focuses on building a 21st century energy system that lowers costs for homeowners and businesses and reduces carbon emissions to help achieve the state's climate change goals. They are going to be hosting various public information meetings that actually begin in Willimantic tomorrow on August 14th, and they continue in Bridgeport on the 16th, in New London on the 21st, in Torrington on the 29th, and in Hartford on the 6th. There's also one scheduled in New Haven at the Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station in September 7th. So if there's something that you hear on this program that piques your interest, they'd be happy to hear you. And this kind of dovetails really well into our recent visits with folks talking about the Connecticut Draft Water Plan and other initiatives. So we're so pleased to meet and make the acquaintance of Mary Soto. She's on the line with us. She is the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection's Deputy Commissioner for Energy. Mary, great to meet you.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So let's dig right in here. Since the establishment of DEEP versus the DEP back in 2011 and the release of the state's first ever comprehensive energy strategy 2 years later, Connecticut has really been putting energy policies and programs in place with an eye toward the future. And Connecticut is now being looked to as a national leader in addressing various changes in energy policies and systems and climate change. Tell us a little bit about the background and the lead up to the 2017 strategy and draft that is now going to be talked about through these course of public meetings.
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, our first comprehensive energy strategy was published about 4 years ago, and it teed up some specific, recommendations and strategies for the state to pursue trying to achieve cleaner, cheaper, more reliable energy. So that's the same mantra, I think, that we use today to guide our decisions. But the strategies that were teed up in 2013, have yielded some very interesting results. And so that's a lot of what we were analyzing this time around was looking at, for instance, we made a big push to do large-scale renewable energy procurements. So that's where we in the Energy Bureau actually solicit, large-scale wind, solar, offshore wind, fuel cells, all types of renewable energy, as well as energy efficiency and storage, you know, other resources that are providing a similar benefit to the grid to give us their projects. So we made some selections of over 400 megawatts of renewable energy for the state. And so we, you know, based on that kind of experience, we said, well, what can we learn from this and how does that inform our strategy going forward? One of the things we learned was that the pricing, the actual cost of those kind of projects has been coming down tremendously over the last several years. So what that tells us is that we actually can get increasingly clean energy for cheaper, you know, than we have in the past. So that's great news. Mm-hmm. And has informed our focus this year on actually expanding our state's renewable portfolio standard. So that's the amount of renewable energy we require the utilities to procure. We've increased that. We are recommending an increase of that to be 30% by 2030. We are currently operating under a requirement to have 20% by 2020.
Mm. Well, I think it is most awesome when you look at initiatives that not only have the impact of proliferating amongst consumers at a lower cost to them to acquire, but even initiatives that passively provide economic advantages to utility consumers and energy consumers, and collaterally also help save the planet or preserve and protect, lower carbon emissions and impact global warming, or at least work in some small way that we can in our tiny little state against the global damage that's been done so far and continues to be done. Speaking to that, from your perspective, and maybe not even in terms of the philosophy of the DEEP, but yourself and given your background, could you just convey to folks that are listening how much of a difference that the kind of work Connecticut is doing could potentially have a positive impact on a national or even global scale?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we can't underestimate how important the actions and the policies that we pursue here are for both, as you mentioned, for the country and internationally. At a national level, you know, Connecticut has been a part of the sort of first wave innovation in a lot of areas in the energy space, one being the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, which we refer to as REGI. So that was the first carbon cap and trade program for the power sector that we and many other states here in the Northeast and the Mid-Atlantic have been a part of for, gosh, now almost, I think, 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, you've now seen California adopt a program to a similar cap and trade program. Those were the same ideas that the EPA had used in its formulation of the Clean Power Plan, you know, focused on these market-based mechanisms to drive down carbon.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one way that, you know, we've been on the forefront, again, a small state working in collaboration with other states to try out, sort of pilot and show that these types of programs can work.
Very good.
The other is, our deregulated electricity market up here in the Northeast. You may know many other states in the U.S. are part of that type of market structure, but many are not. Many still have traditionally vertically integrated regulated utilities. Mm-hmm. What I think that experience here in Connecticut has shown us is that, we've been able to introduce more competition into how we generate electricity, and that's meant that we've gotten lower cost generation. And that results in savings for consumers.
Excellent. Well, the draft 2017 Connecticut Energy Survey focuses on five key themes, which we'll dig into a little bit more deeply. But we want to drive people to review those as early as today, because public comment is open. There's a 60-day public comment period, which ends on September 25th. And to facilitate those comments in an in-person environment, a number of public meetings have been scheduled across the state. So first, we want to get people to go to ct.gov/DEEP/energy strategy. There you can review or download and read the CES executive summary or the full text of the strategy, and then turn out, if you choose, to one of the public meetings to provide input or ask questions. They start tomorrow, August 14th, at Webb Hall at Eastern Connecticut State University in Willimantic. Pick up on August 16th at Beacon Hall Events Center at the Housatonic Community College in Bridgeport. August 21st at Fort Trumbull State Park Conference Center in New London. The 29th at the Torrington City Hall. And on September 6th at the Gina McCarthy Auditorium, very appropriate, at the DEEP's Hartford office in Hartford, and then wrap up on September 7th at the Jones Auditorium at the Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station in New Haven. So we're on the line right now with Mary Soto. She is the Connecticut DEEP's Deputy Commissioner for Energy, and we've got about 5 or 6 more minutes left with you, Mary. So if you could move us through some of the high points of the 5 key themes that people need to kind of be aware of as they're reading through either the executive summary or the full draft of the CES report.
Definitely. Well, you know, I'll tell you, it is a comprehensive strategy. I think it's our draft here is over 200 pages. So you know, I think what you'll see in those themes is that we've organized our recommended goals and strategies around 3 different sectors. So we have goals and strategies around the power sector, around buildings and home heating, and then around the transportation sector. So through all of those sectors, what we're trying to advance is energy policy that supports our climate goals. Now, this, you know, we will also have a separate document coming up next year that will be a climate action plan once our Governor's Council on Climate Change makes some recommendations around what our midterm or 2030 climate target should be for the state. So this is an energy document that should be, you know, trying to align with and support those climate goals.
Mm-hmm.
And to support that, you'll see again this sort of focus on increasing our renewable energy deployment, looking at the conditions for a diverse zero carbon generation mix. So that includes, a focus on evaluating the role of nuclear energy in our resource mix. As well as looking at other ways that we can continue to deploy renewable energy, both considered behind the meter, sort of the smaller scale stuff, solar on your rooftops,
mm-hmm.
Shared clean energy programs, as well as this focus on our large scale renewables where we can get sort of a bigger bang for the buck, so to speak. But we also have a focus on trying to support grid modernization. And that's a term that you hear a lot, and it can mean a lot of different things. But for us, it means, you know, trying to embrace and find new ways to innovate this grid of the future. So part of that means a more resilient grid. So we have a microgrid program that was developed in the last few years, I think the first in the nation, in fact, the first state program to actually deploy. I think we have 5 operational microgrids now, and we want to continue that program and expand it further throughout the state. So, you know, a grid of the future would be one that can island off, is the sort of the term. So provide more resiliency in the face of, extreme weather events or other outages to keep critical facilities intact and online.
Excellent. There's also, there's also a push to enhance convenience for folks purchasing electric vehicles.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, I think when we look at the, from a climate perspective, the kind of electric vehicle deployment that would be needed, or the conversion of, internal combustion engines to electric vehicles, thinking of that process, you know, we know there's positive trends there. A number of auto manufacturers have said that they're making the commitment to increase the number of EVs that they're producing and also stop producing, you know, fossil fuel consuming vehicles into the future. But for us, I think our transportation chapter really tries to focus on, again, that decarbonization goal. But as you mentioned, also just thinking more broadly about how can we make clean and accessible transportation options even greater for, you know, for Connecticut citizens. So some of the things that we did since 2013 as a state, you know, were to expand the CT Fast Track. So, you know, bus rapid transit systems, mm-hmm. Dedicated lanes for buses, particularly around the Hartford area. I think those programs have been more successful than mm-hmm. Was predicted. So that's a positive trend we can build on. But also thinking about, you know, if we're going to want more folks to buy electric vehicles, then we need to have the infrastructure to support that.
Right.
So that means more charging stations in the places where people are going to want to charge their vehicles. And, you know, the reality is all of that, you know, comes with a cost. So
yes,
we need to figure out the best ways to finance those options.
Very good. Well, if any of this conversation has been stimulating to you, we once again want to drive you to ct.gov/DEEP/energy strategy to review the draft of the 2017 Connecticut Energy Strategy. Feel free to comment on them. The comment period is open now and into late September, September 25th, as a matter of fact, and statewide workshops and Q&A sessions are beginning as early as tomorrow. You can get all the information and head out to one of those as well. Our guest this morning is Mary Soto. She's the Connecticut DEEP Deputy Commissioner for Energy, and I guess we'll be coming back around to talk to you once this second report is generated in about a year, Mary. So great to meet you, and thanks so much for being part of the program. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and do not necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.vocat@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours in the New Haven area at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford, and for our Hartford stations at 869 Blue Hills Avenue in Bloomfield. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. This is John Vocat, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab at our radio station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.